The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Pippa Carrera. Ireland goes to the polls this week in a referendum to change its constitution and give women the right to abortions. Polls are tight and turnout is likely to be key to the result. Emotions are running high and tempers are frayed on televised debates.
We should at least be able to agree on facts.
But has social media shaped and distorted the campaign? Also this week, Sajid Javid made his first appearance as Home Secretary in front of the Police Federation.
What I will say is that I am listening and that I do get it. I will prioritise police funding in the spending review next year.
And we hear from Mark Lilla, author of a new polemical book, The Once and Future Liberal.
We need to recapture that sense of liberalism as having a broad, hopeful message, a national narrative in countries to stand up against populism on the right that is a threat everywhere.
This Friday, Irish voters go to the polls to decide the future of one of the country's most emotive laws. The Constitution currently grants a right to life of the unborn, and it has been used to deny Irish women abortions in all but a tiny number of cases. The law means women often travel from Ireland to the UK for terminations. Siobhan Donoghue will be voting yes on Friday to constitutional change. She explained why in a Guardian video.
My baby had been diagnosed with anencephaly, which meant the top half of his brain and skull had never formed. I found myself in a position where I could not continue with that pregnancy, but because of the Eighth Amendment in Ireland, my only option was to travel to the UK to access services there. It was such an undignified feeling to have to herd yourself through and get onto a flight, literally hours after having given birth to your dead baby. The fact that my baby died because he had anencephaly, that's something that's in my history. It's something we talk about in my family. It's something I talk about with my children. It's something we have come to accept. But somebody intentionally put an amendment in my country's constitution that blocks me from accessing services that I needed at the most difficult time in my life. And that hurts.
But those on the no side are equally passionate.
I would be devastated if we repealed it, and I would disassociate from the Irish nation. I really would. Every other country, they imposed abortion on the people. They didn't get a vote in it. So I'd be thoroughly ashamed, and I would be embarrassed, and I wouldn't want to describe myself as Irish.
So what will happen to Western Europe's strictest abortion laws if Ireland votes yes on Friday? Joining me on the line is Professor Owen Carolan, an expert in the Constitution at University College Dublin. Owen, what does the Eighth Amendment actually do, and how did it come about?
Well, what the Eighth Amendment says is that it guarantees the right to life of the unborn as equal to the right to life of the mother. And the background to it really is that it was voted in a referendum by the people in 1983, and that came after a campaign in the late 70s and early 1980s, which really was motivated by an expressed concern that the Supreme Court might follow what had been done in the US in Roe versus Wade and recognise some kind of constitutional entitlement to abortion as part of the right to privacy.
And what would a yes vote mean?
A yes vote would replace the current Article 40.33 with what's called an enabling provision, which is basically a provision which says that the Oireachtas, the Parliament, can legislate in the area for the termination of abortions. So it would essentially pass the matter over to the Oireachtas, the Parliament, and they would then make decisions about what the appropriate laws should be in that area.
And is the political will there to make a change?
The parties have largely given a free vote on the issue, so while the leaders of the political parties generally have been in favour of repeal, some of the backbenchers on of the main parties have disagreed. We also have the slightly unusual position in Ireland at the moment that we have a minority government that is governing with the support of other parties. So it's a question of parliamentary arithmetic. They seem to be confident that the law will be changed after the government have announced some proposals as to what they intend to do. But if the referendum does pass, I think attention will quickly focus to what shape legislation might take. There is legislation at the moment, and if the referendum passes, that legislation will remain in place until such time as there's a majority in the Oireachtas for a change.
And what happens if Ireland votes no?
If Ireland votes no, essentially the position remains as it is. The constitutional provision would remain the same, and the law would continue to be that 2013 Act, which essentially limits abortion to situations where there's a real and substantial threat to the life of the mother.
Britain has its own referendum angst, as I'm sure you know. But do you think referendums are an effective way to settle these highly charged questions in Ireland?
We probably have slightly more experience with them. The only way our constitution can be amended is by referendum, and this is the 36th time there's been a referendum since 1937. So, and they've been increasingly common in recent years, so the public is slightly, I think, slightly more used to referendums, probably slightly more aware of the kind of practices that can go on around referendums. And we also have a very highly regulated environment. The Supreme Court in Ireland has recognised a lot of constitutional restrictions around how public money can be used for campaigning. They generally say it can't be used to advocate for a particular result. And there's also restrictions around airtime and to ensure equality between the sides. So it's quite a familiar environment for Irish voters. There are still issues around referendum. People, you know, there is a view that complicated issues are difficult and are ones that perhaps shouldn't be committed to referenda. And that's certainly been the case in Ireland in respect of, for example, European treaties, which are, you know, very complicated, very difficult to understand the nuances around them. But on something like this, I think people do understand the issues. It is an issue that people have a sense of. And certainly there's been, I think, a high level of engagement on both sides during the campaign.
Professor Owen Carolan there at University College Dublin. Well, I'm joined now by my panel. In Dublin, our reporter Lisa O'Carroll, and here in London, Sinead Baker and Jim Worterson. Lisa, we're talking to you on the eve of the election. What do the polls show, and how are both sides feeling about their potential result?
I'm here in Dublin, and it is quite intense at the moment. The polls have a few weeks or months back would have shown a very strong lead to the Yes campaign. But they have dropped and the No campaign is creeping up and there is a large group of undecided. So I think everyone here thinks that it's going to be extremely close, maybe a 52-48 in favour of Yes. But I think the Yes campaign are feeling that they will be lucky if they come out of it with a victory, and the No campaign are too anxious to call and to be that optimistic. But it's extremely intense. It's in your face. Coming in from the airport yesterday, the No campaign is much, much more vocal. It's much more emotional. It reminds me of the Brexit referendum campaign, where the No side strategically went for the emotional play compared to the Yes side, which has gone for a cerebral play in this campaign. But it's very, very interesting. Ireland's very, very politicised. Everybody's talking about it. Everybody has a view. And you'd be quite surprised at the types of people who are voting No or intending to vote No. They're not just... This isn't about the Catholic Church. This is about morality.
Well, I was going to ask, how is the debate being conducted, and have the main parties taken positions? And you mentioned the Church. What about their influence?
Well, it isn't about the Catholic Church. Absolutely not. And I was just speaking to somebody this morning who was saying if this had been a campaign that had been called on the back of a Catholic Church request, 20% would have voted yes. It would have been overwhelming no. Ireland has moved on. It's grown up a series of scandals in relation to paedophilia in the Catholic Church, in relation to unmarried mothers and how they were treated in kind of prison-like conditions in centres run by nuns, has left a very long shadow on the Catholic Church, and they don't have credibility in this. This really isn't about Catholicism. It's about the morality of abortion. It's very strong.
And the main parties, have they taken positions?
Yeah, so Fine Gael, Ireland is very like Britain. There's a supply and confidence agreement between two parties. They are the two main parties. It's a bit like the Tories and the Labour Party in power, but the Tories, the more right-wing party, centre-right, have got the edge. So they're called Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, who were dominant for decades and who were annihilated after the crash, are the minority party in government. So both leaders have campaigned on the Yes side. The referendum was called on the back of a long constitutional inquiry, starting off with the Citizens' Assembly and then a committee in government, and then the Oireachtas, which is the parliament, agreed to go ahead with referendum. So Micheál Martin, the head of the Fianna Fáil party, came out very early doors and said he was going to campaign for yes. But the party is not united on this front, whereas in Fine Gael, they are more or less united up behind the yes. So there would be very, very interesting political ramifications for Fianna Fáil, for Fine Gael, and also for Sinn Féin. It's very, 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 very interesting time in Ireland at the moment.
Okay, and Sinead, you're here in London, where a lot of Irish women are preparing to fly back to vote.
Yeah, so we saw it really for the first time in the 2015 same-sex marriage referendum, where sort of tens of thousands of Irish people living across the globe flew back specifically on the day of the vote in order to sort of have their say, because you can't vote from abroad in Ireland through an embassy or anything like that. So there's a massive cohort of young people planning on going from London, but also from further afield, from Australia, from America. And you even have situations where young people who are no longer eligible to vote because they've been living outside the country for too long are going home to canvass or to talk to their families or to simply be in the country to see the legislation potentially go through, because they have every intention of returning back to Ireland in the future.
Have you got any idea of what sort of numbers are going back and whether there will be enough to make a difference?
I don't have any idea of the numbers. Whether or not they can make a difference sort of remains to be seen. I think in general, it's mostly young people who are flying back, simply because they're the ones who are more likely to still have a vote. And I think youth turnout in general is going to have a massive impact on this referendum. It's definitely incorrect to say that all the young people support a yes vote in this referendum, but in general, certainly the youth establishment and sort of students' unions have been campaigning on this issue for years, and they're the demographic sort of most in favour of a yes.
If I could just come in there, Pippa, the numbers are there are 3.2 million people who are registered to vote. There are 40,000 people only who are eligible overseas to vote. So those are people who are still ordinarily resident technically in Ireland and who have not been out of the country for longer than 18 months. So it's mostly students. But some referenda, I mean, Ireland is used to referendas, have been absolute knife edge. And one of them was the difference between the yes and the no was 7,000 votes. So it is a numbers game.
Right, interesting.
And the turnout in these sorts of referendums is typically quite low. So in 2002, for example, which was the last vote that Ireland had on abortion, the turnout was only 43%. Potentially, the issue is so divisive that some people just decide not to cast their vote, although actually turnout in referendums in Ireland is never particularly high. So there is a chance that, given everything looks so close, that extra people flying home could make the difference.
So, Sinead, Lisa mentioned it being at its heart a moral issue, but this issue has also often been pitched as one of young versus old, which you've just touched on. Is it more complicated than that?
I think it definitely is. There's certainly quite a large groundswell of support for a no vote among young people, among students, and quite a few of the no campaign figureheads of our students or recent graduates. And in addition, something that we've really seen is older women coming out in favour of a yes vote and really sort of taking charge in that respect. The Yes campaign has really sought to put experts and older people at the forefront, whether it's Grandparents for Appeal, whether it's doctors, lawyers, older women who've been canvassing on this issue for decades, whether it's women who had their own abortion experience decades ago and couldn't speak about it until now. They've made a really conscious effort to play up that aspect of the campaign, while the no side has actually made the effort to put young people who support their cause at the front and centre. So there's been sort of an interesting flip in terms of image between the two campaigns there.
And Jim, as ever in emotive binary campaigns, there's a pretty toxic debate online, isn't there? But how are the two sides using social media and online advertising?
Well, I've dipped into this quite late in the referendum, but from the last sort of few days of reporting on this, it, to my mind, looks like the no side have a far more effective online campaign with a really simple message that they're just hammering home with quite brutal efficiency. So it's a similar thing that we saw in the EU referendum, really clear messages put out on Facebook and also through ad systems that almost no one can stop them circulating around the internet. So, I mean, the background is that Google has issued a blanket ban on all adverts relating to the referendum from its platform. Facebook has said it's going to try and do its best to ban adverts from people placed by overseas organisations. So, for instance, US anti-abortion groups were getting involved. But fundamentally, if you've got money and you want to buy ad space online, it's normally possible to do it. And therefore, these ads are all over the internet if you're an Irish user browsing almost any site at the moment.
And The Guardian was among those news sites that take algorithmic online ads and was unwittingly caught up in all of this.
Yeah, The Guardian, if you were looking at things from ranging from The Washington Post to The Atlantic, all these sites I phoned up yesterday, all of them said this stuff should not be on our site. Guardian said, we don't know why it's there, really. We can't understand how it's got through our filters. And yet, fundamentally, if you put up a campaign that only has to last for a few weeks. It doesn't really matter. There's very few legal ramifications in Ireland for spending returns or anything like that. So you basically do what you can during the referendum period, and then the result is declared, and there's very little that anyone can do to enforce any sort of punishment after the fact for stepping over the line.
And you mentioned, Jim, that this issue has obviously generated a lot of issue abroad. Do we know that foreign money has paid for any of these ads?
It's always so hard to exactly prove where the money came from. There are pretty clear links between some of the organisations who are placing ads and US organisations in particular. But Irish spending law, as far as I can see, electoral spending law, seems to be largely non-existent. There's no need to declare how much you've spent, who spent it. The only thing is registering where your donations came from. But even then, there's ways around it. And one of the main issues from talking to the Irish campaigners on the internet side of things in the last few days has just been the extent to which they're saying our laws are written in the early 90s when the idea of people communicating online was only geeks and a few students were doing it. And now this is what we're having to contend with as a result.
And Sinead, if Yes wins on Friday, will there be a push to further liberalise the abortion laws beyond the proposed 12 weeks, do you think?
I think it's incredibly hard to say. And I think that ultimately the Yes campaign would, first of all, just sort of take in its victory, because it's so likely to be a narrow victory. There's so likely to be backlash to a given Yes victory. So the No campaign has been arguing all along that 12 weeks would open the floodgates to essentially abortion up to 6 months, even further, like abortion on demand with essentially no regulation. So the Yes vote will probably be hesitant to give credence to that view. And certainly its main spokespeople wouldn't call for anything immediately.
Well, there hasn't been a detailed parliamentary bill, Pippa. There is kind of a heads of agreement, which is part and parcel of this referendum. So if there's a Yes victory, a victory for the Yes side, rather, they will have to go back to Parliament and there will have to be a detailed bill. And you will have all these arguments again about the 12 weeks, the 6 months, the near-fatal. I mean, it's really, really interesting. There are a lot of left-wing progressive people here who will be voting no because they've got a moral problem with abortion on demand, and they don't want Ireland to be like the UK. That's been quite a strong part of the campaign here, used by the No side. We don't want abortions up to 22, 24 weeks, whatever it is in the UK.
The direct comparison to the UK is something that's really, really obvious. The posters on the streets cite UK statistics and say, don't let that happen here, even though the proposed legislation is more similar to Switzerland than it is the UK. For example, statistics around Down syndrome, statistics around the number of abortions that take place, they're all being used by the No campaign. And I think, as we've said, this sort of idea of it being almost a Brexit moment is almost the No side adopting similar things that we saw during the Brexit campaign too. So the UK influence is very strong. Even UK religious groups are flying over to Ireland to canvass and to pray on the streets, even though they're not Irish citizens, they're not voting themselves as well.
Well, you can follow our live coverage of the referendum results on Saturday morning on theguardian.com. The appearance in front of the Police Federation is one of the dreaded moments in the calendar of any Home Secretary. In the past, it has been a chance for unhappy officers to voice their displeasure at budget cuts or government policy. Some, like Theresa May, have used it as a chance to make a tough stand. This week, the new Home Secretary, Sajid Javid, got his first taste of it. Well, I'm joined now by The Guardian's Vikram Dodd. Vikram, how did Javid go down? He struck a very different tone from one of his predecessors in particular.
So Sajid Javid went to the Police Federation, which he opened by saying is the toughest speaking gig any politician has. And his message was, and tone was, very different. So he accepted one of the central claims that the police have been saying since the Conservatives started cutting their budgets, which is that they are under increasing demand. He said they need more resources. And all that was designed to give the impression that he was on their side and that the days of them feeling they were being beaten over the head by the Home Secretary are over.
And do you think that was successful? What was the reception to his speech?
I would say it's the warmest reception I've seen a Home Secretary get at the Police Federation for some time, but I've got to be honest, the bar was very, very low. The Conservatives, don't forget, had cut police budgets and police numbers by over 20,000, and Theresa May especially. Her most famous speech, or most best example of this, was 2014, had basically told the Police Federation, you're wrong, you're shroud waving, all these warnings about cuts causing a rise in crime are wrong, and we've done all that, and look, crime is falling. Now the numbers tell a different story, and there's a different tone from Sajid Javid. He also said that he has been part influenced by the fact that his brother is a senior cop, and he was moved by the difficulties and horrible things that had happened to his brother whilst he was serving as an officer. Is it successful? Well, I think the test will be how he gets on in the spending review, which is upcoming, with the Treasury. If he's back in a year's time at the Police Federation with no extra money, I would have thought he's got to have a hard time. And the, let's call it a rhetorical device, he had to bat off difficult questions, which was, I've only been in the job for 3 weeks, a kind of, I think I called it a sort of Bambi on ice routine. I doubt he'll be able to pull that off next year. But for now, his desire to reset the relationship between government and the police seems to be off to a decent start.
And among all the firefighting he's doing on the Windrush scandal and how busy he is in other areas, how high a priority will policing actually be?
I think policing hasn't for quite a long time been wildly high on the agenda and what people tell pollsters they're concerned about. But crime is rising and violent crime is rising. And the other thing is it's getting headlines. So I'm the police and crime correspondent. A murder on the streets would very rarely generate much desire for coverage from editors, etc. That has changed, and that has changed, I think, for every news organisation. So I think it's going to be a higher priority than it was a couple of years ago because the dynamics have changed.
The Guardian's Vikram Dodd there. In the days following the shock election of Donald Trump in America, the country's dumbfounded experts, pollsters and columnists grasped for explanations for what had just happened. One piece in particular cut through, and it became the New York Times' most read political column of the year. Now it has been expanded into a book, The Once and Future Liberal, After Identity Politics, and its author, Mark Lilla, is here with me now. Mark, the way you tell it, Trump's victory was a long time in the making.
That's right, and that's an important thing to bear in mind. There's been so much focus on Hillary Clinton as a candidate, things that happened during the campaign, but it's really a 35-year history that one has to understand to really measure the significance of, on the one hand, the rise and fall of Reaganism, which is dead now, on the one hand, and the other is the abdication of the Democratic Party and liberals more generally from the task of offering a political vision of the country and a national narrative that would draw people together. So the past three decades, you've seen on the one hand, Republicans increase their power, especially at the state and local level, become increasingly radical, and Democrats becoming less and less able to meet them on the ground politically in large sections of the country.
It's a phrase which is bandied about a lot, often as an insult now, but can you explain what you mean by identity politics?
Well, there are really two things get called identity politics, and I'm focused on one of them. One kind of identity politics is just normal democratic politics. That is that there's a group of people who share a common problem or want to make a common demand, and they use what they share together to mobilize to participate in the political system. And you can call that identity politics. That's fine. But that's just normal politics. And what it does is that it gets people into the normal democratic game of building a coalition, persuading people who don't agree with you of your ideas, and marching through the institutions. A different kind of identity politics has grown up over the past few decades, and that's focused not on institutional politics or even movements to change policy so much as it is about social recognition and changing the culture. So we're undergoing two things simultaneously right now in the States. We're undergoing a political revolution that's coming from below, that's a democratic revolution, it's populist. And we have a cultural revolution that's going on that's being driven by cultural elites in order to change the way we think and behave towards minorities and women and all the rest. A lot of good things are coming out of that. But the focus on these cultural questions has taken the eye off the ball for people on the left from the basic task of developing a vision for the country and its future that could reach more people than just members of these groups.
Yet it wasn't that long ago that pollsters were looking at America's changing demographics and predicting sweeping majorities for the Democrats. Was that really so wrong?
Oh, it was very wrong for many reasons. To begin with, people have multiple identities now, right? So if you look at the proportion of people who claim only to be white, that percentage is declining. It's in the 60s right now. But if you look at people who claim either to be entirely white or have identify as white but also as something else, it's 80-some percent. It's still an overwhelmingly white country. But more importantly, when ethnic groups in particular do better financially and socially, they tend to become more conservative. So as these groups do better, they're going to become more conservative. As they get older, they're going to become more conservative. And also, groups don't behave in the simple way that people who promote identity politics thinks. For example, Donald Trump won nearly 20% of the Hispanic vote in America. Now, that's because Hispanics, you know, can't be just put into a simple little box. They're also Catholic, and they're culturally very conservative, right? And a lot of them resent illegal immigrants who they feel are making their lives harder and driving their wages down. Last point is that in the states where Democrats need to win, the vast middle of the country where they cannot protect blacks or women or gay people because they don't control state government, those states are overwhelmingly white and religious. You have to reach those people.
So when do you think that the politics of the left began to change? I mean, hasn't it always been this broad church of, on the one hand, single-issue campaigners, and on the other, more hard-headed pragmatists?
Well, part of that is just normal democratic small-d democratic politics. But no, I think from the period of from the Great Depression down until the election of Ronald Reagan, a period I call the Roosevelt dispensation, there was behind all of that jockeying a kind of shared understanding of what kind of country we were trying to build. We were trying to electrify the Tennessee Valley. We were trying to provide benefits for veterans returning from war. We were giving educational benefits, and on, right? And so there was a shared understanding that as a country, we stick together, solidarity, and the other, equal protection under the law. And being a liberal, someone on the left, meant that you put first those principles. After the crack-up of the late 60s and early 70s, people on the left migrated more into social movements and out of political parties. I think that's also true in Britain as well. First into social movements that were tied to just single issues, but single issues that kind of affected everyone, like the environment, for example, and then shifted to identity movements that became increasingly narrow and self-absorbed, especially when gender politics got involved, sexual politics. And when you have, you know, the logic of social movements is such that there's a benefit to being more radical than the person next to you, because the more radical you are, the more likely you are to lead this movement. Party politics works in the opposite direction. It forces you to move away from radical positions, move towards the center in order to capture more votes from people. So a primacy for ideological purity comes along with movement politics that are detached from parties. And the more that continues, the more detached people in the movements become from, you know, the broad center of any democratic country.
And tell us about you. Your title is Once and Future Liberal. Does that mean you're not currently a liberal?
Oh, no, on the contrary. On the contrary, you know, it's a reference to the T.H. White book, of course, about King Arthur, those fantasy books. No, the title captures that once we were a certain kind of liberal that focused on a large message for the country, and we need to become liberals like that again, not by going back to the same message. Too much has changed. Our societies are different. Economy is different. Technology is different. Our attitudes towards each other. But we need to recapture that sense of liberalism as having a broad, hopeful message, a national narrative in countries to stand up against populism on the right that is a threat everywhere.
Is the real tangible evidence for your theory, though, a few extra votes here and there and Hillary Clinton would be president and all the focus would be on the crisis for the right and a historic first woman president? How are you sure that you're right?
Well, one never is sure one's entirely right, but there's too much focus on the presidency. So, you know, we have a daddy complex with the presidency in the United States, and we don't focus on the fact that Congress can pretty much block most presidential initiatives, as we saw during the Obama years. But the important story is what's happened at the state and local level, because states and localities have tremendous power. For example, 6 weeks ago or so, the state of Iowa voted to ban abortion, make abortion illegal the moment that the heartbeat of the fetus can be heard, which is 6 weeks, which is before most women know they're pregnant. Now, they're itching for a Supreme Court fight over this. But the fact is that we have a constitutional right to abortion in the United States. And there's maybe a quarter of the country where it's virtually impossible or very hard for a woman to get an abortion or to run or for doctors to perform them. That's because of state law. Now, electing a woman president won't change that. Getting a congressional majority won't change that. You have to go to Iowa and win office in Iowa. And to win office in Iowa, you have to face the fact that it's 80% white and very religious. So if you care about women, you have to be competitive in all these places.
You have to make compromises.
Well, it's not so much compromises. You have to work tactically, right? That you have to become part of some, you know, larger group that's trying to reach a common goal. And one part of that is going to be protecting women, but it's not the be-all and end-all of what the party's about.
You talk about being more tactical or more pragmatic. One of the many quotable lines in the book is, "We need no more marchers, we need more mayors." And also, "Elections are not prayer meetings." But is it a simple case of one or the other? Can't both forms of liberalism coexist?
Well, look, they can coexist. There have always been social movements, but the mind of the American liberal is simply not focused today on developing a vision of the country that can capture the imagination of people pretty much everywhere. Reaganism was that, you know? I mean, he had a vision of the country. It was an anti-political vision of the country. And it was simple to understand. It filled people with hope. And it turned out to be, in most respects, empty, because it assumed that if we just get government off our backs and allow businesses to make money, it's going to trickle down, everyone would be better off. It's not true, right? But it was a vision of what kind of world we want to live in. Democrats do not have that. They look out their window, party leaders, and all they see are tribes. They don't see a nation that they have to address as a nation. And that's the fundamental mistake.
So you've suggested that that sort of identity politics has prevented liberals from governing or almost made it impossible for them to achieve anything really significant. But what about movements like the civil rights movement or the gay rights movement in the United States? Couldn't they both, over many decades, have been considered a success?
Oh, absolutely. But that was then. Right. That was a time when the political system was not delivering. But more importantly, you had Democrats in office. If you have social movements on the left and you have Republicans in office, they do not care. They are not listening. You only have hold as a social movement on the left if you have people who are liberal or on the left in power. And so gaining power comes first. Now, it's true that that the system was blocked. It was not responding regarding civil rights for African Americans, women, and gays. And it was a time when social movements could really change things. But the situation is different now, you know? We can't practice our grandparents' politics anymore. We're in a situation in which there's populism rising around the world. Republicans have become increasingly radical. They control most of the institutions of power in our country. That is the fight of our time. You can't be stuck in the past.
Now, of course, social movements are very reliant on social media, and you've said that Facebook in particular is a dangerous manifestation of the narcissism of the left. How do we begin to grapple with that?
Well, that's a fact of life, and that's a very hard problem, you know. As I do say in the book, and I would need to say more about it, maybe I will in another book, identity politics that we have today, like the kind of libertarian economics that we got with the Reagan administration, actually do respond to something real in our societies. And that is we've become more individualistic. We are both more socially libertarian, economically libertarian, and sociologically libertarian. We have smaller families. We don't go to church as much. We don't belong to organizations. We move around a lot. And we're tied to these little machines where we see reflections of ourselves. So the real challenge, it seems to me, is to think about what it would be like to develop a conception of citizenship and duty towards other people that would reach and convince people who are living this sort of libertarian life. And that's an enormous task. But it's first a task for thinking and recognizing the reality of the way we live now.
Now, you argue that current liberals don't take enough time to get to know their conservative fellow citizens. But do you think that you've done enough to understand the people that you refer to as social justice warriors?
Well, I guess I can't be the judge of that. But certainly I live in a liberal environment. I teach in a university. I'm around people like this all the time. I certainly engage with them, right? But there's a kind of cluelessness about a vast section of the country among liberals and the left. And, you know, it's especially fed by media. For example, one out of every five Americans is an evangelical. You will never see an evangelical character on American television or American movies ever. That's one-fifth of the country. Transgender people make up one-third of 1% of the country, and suddenly they have become the focus of a great deal of media and Hollywood attention. That's utter cluelessness when it comes to understanding your society.
So if you think that it's gone in the wrong direction or is going in the wrong direction, how do you beat someone like Trump? What lessons should the Democrats, going back to mainstream party politics for a minute, take into the midterm elections this year and, of course, then the big one in 2020?
I think it would be important to not focus so much on Trump. Trump was a one-off. He's a freak. And he arose, him personally, not the populism so much, but he arose out of a vacuum because this Reagan dispensation has come to an end because no one believes that more tax cuts are going to get us more jobs and make us all better off. People know they need health care and all the rest. So Reaganism is over. The left hasn't offered a large vision of the nation's destiny since the 1960s. And so we end up with a phenomenon like Trump. So to my mind, it's important to try to fill the vacuum, to think long term. And what I'm unfortunately finding is that Democrats, both those who are activists, but those who are in the party, simply do not think long term, and they don't believe in the power of ideas. Isn't that funny? Republicans became convinced that ideas matter in the 1970s. When they came in, they had an agenda, they had a worldview, and all the rest. Democrats don't believe that. They believe in interests only. And so we have to be more intellectually and politically ambitious and think in much more in the long term.
Well, that's all we have time for now. My thanks to Mark Lilla, Vikram Dodd, Sinead Baker, Jim Wortison, Lisa O'Carroll, and Owen Carolyn. Follow all our political coverage at theguardian.com/politics. The producers were Phil Maynard and Simon Barnard. I'm Pippa Carrera. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.